This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Shortly after midnight on June 5th, 1968, 50 years ago today, Robert F. Kennedy was shot and killed as he entered the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. He had just celebrated winning California's Democratic presidential primary. Kennedy ran on the belief that he could unite the country. Here's a moment from his Los Angeles speech.
What I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of the next few months.
So about his comments regarding differences between white and black Americans, Bobby Kennedy may be remembered today as a progressive champion of racial equality, but he too had his blind spots and prejudices about the realities of racism. Kennedy was forced to confront those blind spots in 1963 in a meeting with black artists and activists in Manhattan. And according to Michael Eric Dyson, it was that meeting that helped lead Bobby Kennedy to see racism as more than a political problem, but as a, quote, moral rot at the heart of American empire. Michael Eric Dyson has written about it in a new book. It's called What Truth Sounds Like, RFK, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. And he joins us now from New York. Professor Dyson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before I get to the details of the story that you tell in the book, I'm just wondering if you could share with us the story about your reaction. You were just a young child when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated 50 years ago.
That's right. I was 9 years old when Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. I had lived 2 months and a day before through the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and it was an epic tide of grief that swept over my community at King's death, and certainly the belief was the only person left in America to bear witness to the kinds of truths that Martin Luther King Jr. was articulating, especially from within the political arc of American democracy, was Robert F. Kennedy. Hmm. He represented a new bright hope, the fulfillment of the Kennedy vision of race that his brother had only inchoately instituted when he was president and was murdered in 1963. Yeah. And so when he died, it was a great shock to us. And he was the first white man that I had a sense that black people loved greatly and had invested in profoundly. When his brother Jack Kennedy died, I was five years old, and I didn't have a sense of what his death meant, the magnitude of the grief and loss that were experienced, especially in my community. But with Robert F. Kennedy, that was not true, mm-hmm. and I got a palpable sense, a visceral register of the pain and agony from his death.
Right. I mean, the thing about Bobby Kennedy, though, is that his death, his assassination, has resulted in the, if martyrdom is or isn't the right word, I'm not sure, but I'll use it anyway, the martyrdom of Bobby Kennedy as a racial healer or a potential racial healer. We will never know what he may or may not have actually accomplished. But we do know, you know, some of the things that he did well before running for president, because I think it's interesting to talk about that for a minute or two, because he's got a complex history of his attitudes about race before, you know, in the early 1960s. I mean, for example, when he was attorney general under his brother, as President John F. Kennedy, he wiretapped Martin Luther King.
Yeah, well, look, it was a mixed record, to be sure. The Kennedys in general have gained more acclaim in death than they perhaps earned in life. That's not a harsh judgment against them. It's an acknowledgement of the times, the temper of the times, as Eric Hoffer might phrase it. His brother got into office in part by currying favor with the black community when he placed a well-timed call to Governor Vandiver in Georgia when Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail, and got him out of jail. And then the black people who could vote registered their approval by supporting him. But at the same time, he was promising Vandiver that he wasn't going to use federal power to intervene in behalf of integration when he got into office. So he's promising black people civil rights and movement on that, and he's kind of placating and mollifying these right-wing bigots who were anti-black and who were trying to keep the bell of progress from ringing. So he was complicated, and Bobby Kennedy started as a kind of fierce advocate for McCarthy in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And then he evolved into a far more liberal figure. But as you say, because in that famous meeting that we'll talk about in a bit, he got upset. He wiretapped many of the people in that meeting, and that led to Martin Luther King Jr. being wiretapped, because one of the figures in the meeting was a lawyer for both Baldwin and Martin Luther King, and they began to pick up information there. So Bobby Kennedy, the lion of liberalism, was also the man who authorized the wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr. and therefore sparked COINTELPRO, which was a vicious program of surveillance of an intimidation of black leaders, among many others.
Yeah. I mean, you also write about how, in certain ways, Bobby Kennedy's attitudes about race were downright naive. He just didn't get sort of, as I quoted you earlier, that it was and is a moral rot in America versus just something that could be quickly taken care of politically. I mean, so that brings us to this meeting in May of 1963 between Bobby Kennedy and some of the brightest black activists, authors, playwrights, just the brightest lights in black America at the time.
Right.
Who called for this meeting?
Well, Bobby Kennedy reached out through Burke Marshall to the Mr. Mills, who was the literary agent of Jimmy Baldwin. But Jimmy Baldwin, James Baldwin, had dashed off a fiery telegram to the attorney general, blaming him and his brother especially for what was going on in Birmingham. You know, like everybody else, he was watching on television as the bicuspids and incisors of police dogs, you know, bit the flesh or at least snarled at the flesh of black people, and water hoses washed them against the wall, women, men, and children. So he was astonished by the lack of intervention or moral leadership of the Kennedy administration and held them to account, along with the ghoulish behavior of Bull Connor. But then he had met Bobby Kennedy in a meeting in the White House of Nobel laureates, and they agreed together that they would meet. And then Bobby Kennedy was having a series of meetings around the country with black figures, among many others, trying to suss out how they could best address issues of racial intolerance and inequality. And in a meeting with Dick Gregory, the great comedian and activist, he suggested that, you know, he being Bobby Kennedy, meet with James Baldwin. So it finally happened.
Can I just jump in here for a second, Professor Dyson? Because I have a little bit of tape that I want to play for folks. This is James Baldwin speaking with Dr. Kenneth Clark on WGBH in June of 1963, so a little bit after this May meeting. But Baldwin talks about sort of one of the things he hoped to get out of.
Can I tell you something before you do it? That might have been the recording that was done the very night of the meeting. With Kenneth Clark.
Okay. I have June here as a date, but we'll double check that. Let's just play the tape here. This is James Baldwin.
Sure. All right.
I think the one who's got to find some way of putting the present administration of this country on the spot, one has got to force somehow from Washington a moral commitment, not to the Negro people, but to the life of this country.
So that's James Baldwin in 1963. Mm-hmm. Michael Eric Dyson, I mean, how did these black thinkers put Bobby Kennedy on the spot, as he said, that day at that meeting?
Right, and that may have been played in June, but it was literally recorded the night of the meeting that they had with Kennedy. And they were late for the recording because the producer, Mr. Morgenthau III, was at the meeting as well. Mm-hmm. So how they tried to put him on the spot and hold him to account was by letting the rage bleed forward. They were not interested in the kind of politics of nicety, what we might call politically correct deference to Mr. Kennedy in the face of his enormous office and the magnitude of his political prestige. James Baldwin was at that meeting, and it happened because when he went to breakfast with Kennedy the first time, there wasn't enough time. The plane was late for James Baldwin. When he got to meet with Kennedy the first time, they only had it half an hour. He said, "Look, the next day I'll be in New York. Why don't you gather some of your friends? And when you're Jimmy Baldwin, some of your friends are Harry Belafonte, Lena Horne, Lorraine Hansberry, right. Kenneth Clark. Yeah, just some people you got in your Rolodex there. hook them up and bring them on over to the house." They did so. And in meeting there, they also had Jerome Smith present, who was a core member, Congress of Racial Equality. And along with John Lewis, he was the most decorated freedom rider ever because he was beat to within an inch of his life so many times, suffered so much physical abuse. So he said, "I'm not interested in what you're this pity parter of this pity patter of this party. I'm interested in something serious. Here we are gathered at your penthouse here, and I want something serious." And he talked about the BS that Kennedy was spewing. I mean, my God, this was astonishing to the Attorney General of the United States of America. And from there, James Baldwin and Lorraine Hansberry especially let the rage run free. They talked about the agony, the pain, the hurt, the disappointment in the Kennedy administration. Bobby Kennedy thought they were going to be grateful Negroes, mm-hmm. for what we have done. And they said, no, they were like Stevie Wonder, "You haven't done nothing, not lately at least. And what you're doing is not sufficient." And Lena Horne and others made that point true. So they held him to account by articulating the very black rage that Kennedy, in part with that meeting, wanted explained.
Yeah. So you mentioned Jerome Smith. And as you well know, there was a terrific documentary made of Lorraine Hansberry's life called Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart by Tracy Stain.
Brilliant, brilliant documentary.
And I want to actually play a little scene from this documentary because when Jerome Smith talked, I mean, it was a turning point in this meeting, right? So, from the documentary, here's Harry Belafonte actually describing the moment that Jerome Smith confronts Bobby Kennedy.
Right.
"He'd been beaten severely, with enough frequency to give him no room for pleasantries. He just bared his soul and all his pain, and then said very aggressively, 'Let me tell you something. In the midst of our oppression, you expect to find us giddily going off to fight a war. It's your war. It's unjust, unfair, and so dishonorable, it should shame you. I wouldn't pick up a gun to fight for this country. I'd die first.'"
That's Harry Belafonte recounting some of what Jerome Smith was telling Bobby Kennedy about African Americans and Vietnam. Now, a little bit later, Lorraine Hansberry, the marvelous playwright, mm-hmm. speaks up, right? And as you were saying, like, really lays into Bobby Kennedy. So here's a little bit from Hansberry's biographer, Margaret Wilkerson, again, from the documentary Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart, describing what happened when Lorraine Hansberry spoke up.
And she says, "Mr. Attorney General, you have a number of very accomplished people here in the room, but the one person whose voice you should listen to is that man," and she points to Jerome. And Kennedy is shocked by that.
"The evening imploded. It was so nakedly honest and so raw."
One of the things that she says, "You are the best of what white America can offer us. If you can't understand this, you who are elected representatives and you with your privilege and the liberal possibilities, if you can't hear what we're saying, then we don't have any hope."
Again, that's from Tracy Strain's documentary, Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart, which, by the way, folks, it's going to be screening this weekend at the MFA. Definitely go check it out if you haven't already. But
it's Michael, an extraordinary documentary. The people need to see that.
Michael Eric Dyson, you know that part where Lorraine Hansberry says, "If you can't understand us, if you can't hear what we're saying, right. then we don't have any hope." Was it clear in the days, weeks after that Kennedy had heard them?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was delayed hearing, though. It was a delayed audibility because at the moment, the height of his emotional catharsis, where he was feeling, you know, assaulted, battered, beat into silence verbally, his own anger precluded the possibility of his hearing. You know how you later on say, "Wait a minute, did I hear you right?" So later on, you recover your sense of audibility, and you recover what you thought you may have heard and you thought you didn't, but now you know you did. And so, you know, Lorraine Hansberry and James Baldwin, is, you know, both of them said, if you can't hear us, if you as a young white man in American society with the potential to discern our racial tones and temperature in this nation, if you can't understand what we're talking about here, our anger, our rage, our resentment, then my God, we have no hope at all. And then later, after his anger subsided, after his resentment diminished, then he did indeed say, hey, look, if I were black, I would react like Jerome Smith. I too would speak out against, you know, going to war. I might have the same attitude, because Bobby Kennedy was deeply insulted that and feeling that he wasn't a good patriot because he wouldn't go die for his country. After all, his older brother, Joseph Jr., had died in war, and his other older brother, John Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, then the president, had been, taken captive, well, you know, had his own problems in World War II. So here was a guy who understood from the price his own family paid that democracy was precious and that patriotism was real. But these black people were trying to tell him there's a different side to this. Imagine those of us who have fought for this country, who have bled and died and can't receive the benefits that you have been able to take for granted. So later on, after that anger subsided, he admitted that it was a different story that should be told. And he began to participate more aggressively in a renewed commitment to racial justice.
You know, and then he in the intervening then 5 years before he's assassinated, as you said, he talks a lot about dialogue, about racial dialogue, not just between whites and blacks in the South, but in the North as well, which is really important. But you know, Bobby Kennedy got assassinated. So I come back to this. Or was assassinated. I come back to this notion of we don't know what he would have accomplished. But what That's we do true. Know is what's in the subtitle of your book, The Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. And we just got a couple minutes left, Professor Dyson. And I got to say, the whole time that we've been talking so far, I'm thinking, here we are in America in 2018. And right now, today, there's the latest brouhaha between the White House and the Philadelphia Eagles, for example.
Right.
About, like, you know, being disinvited, the national anthem, kneeling when none of the Eagles actually did kneel. I mean, it feels as if not only is the conversation about race in America unfinished, but it's aggressively unfinished.
It's aggressively unfinished. We have a racial fascist in the White House. Excuse my term. We got a bigot in chief and a racist in residence. This man is assaulting the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, true enough, Malcolm Jenkins was a noble member of that tribe, so to speak. And he did talk about criminal justice reform. He did talk about the things that were beyond kneeling on a field. He was doing the actual work behind the scenes to make certain that justice was real. Mr. Long, his teammate, has spoken as a white man bravely and courageously against the vicious misinterpretation of the actions of his fellow black athletes and has stood up for them. And for that, their compensation from the president of the United States of America is to be disinvited, a kind of preventive strike against the Philadelphia Eagles, lest they turn him down first, and lest they and highlight and underscore the hypocrisy here. And not only Donald Trump, but Roger Goodell has to wear this too. He has to bear the burden of making a decision that those people, players who will kneel during the playing of the national anthem will be fined. This is, for all of the argument about free speech and the ability to live as free Americans, this is snowflakish. This is whining and complaining and kvetching about the real possibilities of freedom in America. So, yes, this is a tragic reality. And yet, as in my book, the athletes and entertainers and who were activists then in the 1960s, those same kinds of people who are entertainers and athletes now must be active today.
Okay. So we've got a minute left here, though. In 1963, James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, Harry Belafonte, Jerome Smith, they Later were able on. To speak yeah. directly mm-hmm. to Bobby That's Kennedy. Right. Isn't that the fundamental difference now? It seems as Huge. If that kind of direct dialogue seems virtually impossible.
That's right. You got a man who tweets every morning. He's basically tweeting and excreting the feces of his moral depravity into a nation he's turned into a psychic commode. It's a one-way conversation. It's a dialogue. No, it's his venomous, resentful speech unleashed on the country. And there's no dialogue. There's no tolerance of difference. Anybody who disagrees with him, whatever color, race, gender, or sexual orientation, is not truly good or an American. And as a result of that, he is defined down, right? The narrow definition of what is truly American. This is defining the deviance and pathology of his narrowness down to only those who agree with me are true American citizens. This is a travesty of justice, and this is something that all Americans of good conscience must certainly resist.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson is University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University, contributing writer for The New York Times and The New Republic. His new book is What Truth Sounds Like, RFK, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. He's going to be appearing at the First Parish Church in a Harvard Bookstore event tomorrow. We've got more information about that at radioboston.org. Professor Dyson, thank you so very much.
All right. See y'all tomorrow night at 7 p.m. with DeRay McKesson. We're going to have a great time.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.